The Breckshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. It is 4 minutes past six on this lovely sunny Sunday evening, and you're in the studio tonight with me, Aisha. Matt Boothman is here once again.
Hello.
And Vicky Weston is joining us.
I'm back in the studio, guys. Here excited to be here.
Yeah, we've got a really full show on our hands this evening. We are kicking off all of our exciting new Blackshaw production content with Staying Alive, and we're going to be playing you some really lovely interviews with the cast and director Ellie Pitkin. We're going to be talking to Vicky a little bit about Edinburgh, which seems like years and years ago now.
It does.
But it wasn't.
It was really very recently.
Yep. So Vicky's going to be talking to us about her most exciting and interesting thing that you saw up there, I suppose.
Yep, that's what I'm going
to
do.
Matt's going to be talking to us about Paloma. Is that right?
Pomona.
I keep calling it Paloma.
It's because we watched the...
I've got Paloma face.
It's because we watched the rugby yesterday and yeah. She's just all over that thing. So that's what it is.
Doing an interesting thing.
It's Pomona, yes.
Yes, correct. Pomona, the squid face.
I'm excited.
That's the one.
To hear about it.
But before we do all of those exciting things, we are going to first do this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
All right, Matt, you have... We talked about this a lot on a fortnight ago's show, and Vicky and I are pretty excited about it. It is Legend.
Legend, the Tom Hardy movie directed by Brian Helgeland, based on the book by John Pearson about the Cray twins, Ronnie and Reggie, where Tom Hardy plays both of them.
Yes.
How much do you guys know about the Cray twins?
Quite a lot.
Okay, not very much. I read a Wikipedia page, though, quite recently.
See, you probably know already more than I really knew going in.
Okay.
I knew the basics. Like, I knew they were 60s gangsters. They were twins. They were basically a pair of villains. That was basically all I really knew.
I've been to the pub that they bought for their mum.
Well.
It's a cool pub, isn't
it? It's a great pub. Yeah. It's got really nice beers.
Well, I mean, I live in the East End. I live right... In the area where the movie is set, so I was doing a bit of fun location spotting, going, oh, is that Limehouse or Shadwell? Oh, I know that pub, and all that kind of stuff. But actually, I came out of this not knowing a huge amount more than I did going in. Like, I didn't know Ronnie Cray was gay or a paranoid schizophrenic, and those are basically the only two new bits of information I picked up. So obviously the thing that you want to hear about is Tom Hardy's dual performance any good? Because that is how they've marketed it. They haven't really even marketed it as a Cray movie. It's a Tom Hardy does two performances in all the same scenes movie. That has been the selling point for the whole thing, and it's kind of structured. The way the movie is put together is almost structured to show that off as much as possible. So it's very episodic. It jumps a lot in time. Covered by narration from Emily Browning's character Frances, who is Reggie Cray's love interest.
Sure.
And later wife.
Mm-hmm.
So she narrates, and it's sort of, you have a scene, and then there'll be a bit of narration where she goes, and then this, that, and the other happened, and now here is some more of that acting that you paid for. So it's like what they chose to have as a scene rather than elide in narration is very much what do we think would be an interesting thing to see Tom Hardy acting against himself doing.
Oh, really? That's a shame.
That is a shame.
Yeah, and the whole thing is sort of papered over with lots of smooth jazz, which, like, the score really doesn't know when to shut up.
Oh, that is unfortunate.
Yeah, it really is.
Of all the things I thought you would say about that film, that is not what I expected.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't seen it yet, and I am intending to see it, but I never expected for the thing that you really kind of call out to be like, there's a problem with the film.
Too much jazz.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's symptomatic of the general kind of structure problems with it, which is that it's very disjointed and bitty, and like when film scores don't know when to shut up, it's generally because they're trying to smooth over something that is very lumpy and broken.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of sort of what it shows, it's kind of a shallow dive like I say, I didn't really learn much that's new about the craze or the history. In terms of that performance, the differentiation between the two brothers is really strong. Like, there's never a moment where it's visually jarring and where you're thinking, you know, how did they digitally stitch that together so to have two of him on the screen? Or I can really tell that both of those are played by the same guy. They seem like identical twins who look a bit different. You know?
Sure.
So the differential and sort of the way that he sort of Tom Hardy is great at. We already know from it's kind of a hybrid of the two types of character he plays, because he plays characters like the one he plays in Inception, who really knows how to inhabit a suit. Like he knows how to wear the pinstripes and the tie and the tie clip and all the style, and then so that's Reggie, and then Ronnie Cray is very—he's got the thick glasses and he wears cardigans and he's very hunched.
Yeah, he's a bit gibby.
Yeah, and he's got this sort of—he's got this very sort of adenoidal voice.
That's brilliant.
That was such a good impression.
I just love the idea of Tom Hardy doing that, because one of the things I think he does really well is voices.
Yeah, so the voices are, and so it's this kind of slightly sort of light Cockney for Reggie.
Yeah.
So the differentiation is good, but actually that both characterizations are kind of a bit shallow. And I don't think it's necessarily his fault. I think it's the script that is the problem. That basically Ron is violent and unstable, and Reggie is that this movie really wants to redeem Reggie.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's very interested in him being the protagonist and being somebody that you can get behind. So he's basically cast as the sort of the typical gangster drama protagonist who is like an okay guy caught between two difficult situations. So he's pulled between Ron, who is violent and unstable and wants to be a gangster and wants shootouts like in westerns, and Frankie Francis, Emily Browning's character, who is his love interest, who wants him to go straight and just be the legitimate club owner that he is as his public face, because he actually likes owning clubs. So she doesn't see why he has to do the crime as well. So he's sort of pulled between those two. So it really wants you to be sympathetic for him. It almost wants it to be like, you know, the George and Lenny dynamic in Of Mice and Men, where he is, Reggie is George and Ronnie is Lenny, and Reggie is doing his level best to control Lenny while being compassionate. Except that Reg doesn't care who Ron hurts as long as he doesn't sort of expose them to any liability or harm. And he has Hamlet levels of passivity and indecision when it comes to anything to do with Ronnie. He sort of lets him run amok. One of the very first things that happens in the film is Reggie uses intimidation to get Ronnie out of a psychiatric institution, which is where he really needs to be, and the doctor makes it very clear that he needs proper care. But Reggie's idea of family loyalty is not give my brother the care he needs, it's let my brother do what the heck he likes.
Yeah.
Who cares who gets hurt in the meantime. So it's definitely Reggie's film. And then, unfortunately, that means that sort of Ron's illness is in places it's even played for laughs. And a lot of the violence in the movie is played for laughs as well. Ron's illness is there to create conflict for Reg rather than being a sort of a character trait in itself. And the same is true for the other pole that is pulling Reg in the other direction, Frankie. So she's a... she's a female character in a gangster drama, and the bad things that you kind of expect to happen to her do.
Right. Yeah. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. But they're there to illustrate Reg sort of his final descent into villainy rather than anything to do with her. So even though she's the one narrating the movie, it's not her story. It's Reggie Gray's story.
Is it kind of like stuff that happens to her makes him more mean? So there's more of a, like, she's a catalyst for, you know, I'm going to go out and avenge what horrible things have happened to this person I like. Is it going down that route?
Because
I hate that route.
It's it's to show the turning point in him where he's been pulled between sort of the straight path and the crime path throughout the whole movie.
And she's the problem. It's her fault. Is it her fault?
No.
Okay, that's good.
But the what happened without, I don't know. It's a matter of, I presume, from this being based on a book, it's a matter of public record. But what happens to her is just played as, this is an illustration of the path, the fork that Reggie has chosen to take.
Sure. Okay.
And the point at which he becomes irredeemable, rather than it being a character arc for her.
Okay.
As a sort of slightly more lightweight side note, I don't know if you've seen pictures of Emily Browning in this movie. She has the most 60s face I've ever seen.
She really does. She's great in all 60s films.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's just that, how much of it is down to the hair and makeup department, how much of it is just down to her natural facial structure, but she looks more 60s than any living person.
it actually is incredible.
That, like, is a talent.
Yeah. She's been in a lot of period films that around like 50s, 60s time, and I think that's definitely got something to do with it. The fact that she has that look that's, you know, quintessentially 60s, definitely.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, it's a shallow dive through the sort of the events, and I think it's a shallow dive into the characters. And overall, I think it's a bit cheap.
Yeah.
Like it shortchanges the characters. In terms of, like, it doesn't really get under their skin. It shortchanges the actors because they all give their best, but they're not really given much to work with. And it kind of shortchanges the audience because I went in going, I don't really know anything about the craze. Illuminate me. And I didn't really learn anything.
That's so interesting, because I was thinking about this review today, and I think 2 weeks ago I said that I was really definitely going to see this film, but I just didn't get around to it. And I was interested to see if you were going to talk me into seeing this, because either it's I'm talking to you about whether I've seen a film or not, or Matt's talking me into seeing a film. Mm-hmm. And you've not done that.
No.
And it's not because you're a bad reviewer, but because it seems like it's not a...
I don't think I'd recommend it.
No, it doesn't seem interesting or enlightening at all. And I think the thing is with it, the craze are super trendy. Like, everyone that I know and everyone that I live within East London, they're sort of, like, mini craze, you know? Like, they really, like, look at that and...
Yeah, they've got a kind of...
Idolise it in a way, which is kind of
odd idolising of the craze, given that they were criminals and one was obviously incredibly mentally unwell.
Unstable, yeah. And killers as well.
And they terrorised East London for a period of time.
And it's all well and good to turn around and say, oh, you know, but this guy, he bought a pub for his mother because they loved their mum. I'm sorry.
That's so East London.
I'm sorry, but, like, I love my mum, but I'm not going to legitimise my actions by just saying, but I love my mum,
yeah?
Like, that's fine, isn't it? And it's like, no, that's not fine. I think it's a trend thing, and I commend Hardy a lot for doing a role such as this, but I don't think the film...
It's a decent one for his showreel.
I was going to ask a quick question about Tom Hardy in two roles and his Oscar chances.
So,
as a result,
the latest I heard was that he's falling down the rankings in terms of the bookies. Possibly as a result of reviews of this.
I think so, because when it got announced, a lot of things I read were like, oh well, this is a, you know, this is an Oscar, you know, a kind of Oscar nomination, at least, if not a win, for something that's this kind of, like, in-depth character study, does well at the Oscars, and doing something a bit unusual or a bit challenging, and that's a stretch of your acting talent, is obviously a good shout at the Oscars.
The Oscars like something that's a bit showy, and it's sort of obviously, like, an acting challenge.
Yes, it's like, this is acting, not just a film. You have done real acting. You have honed your craft, and you've done something interesting with it. And this should be a good example of that in practice, in theory.
In theory, yeah. But I can see why he's falling down the rankings, because he's just not given enough to work with to make it an Oscar-worthy
from the movie for him, which
that is a shame. Yeah.
Terrible. Well, thank you for that, Matt. I don't think anyone in the studio is going to go and see Legend. sorry, Legend.
I do feel a little bit disappointed, if I'm honest.
Sorry, Tom Hardy, because I love Tom Hardy. Yes. I love him as a person, from what I know of his public persona. But I didn't think it was very good.
Oh, that's a shame.
Who in this studio likes Matt Damon in space? Because I've heard that Matt is going to be doing something very exciting in 2 weeks' time. What is it, Matt?
Yeah, so there's a fair few films out in the next couple of weeks, but we were talking about this before, and we reckon it's going to be The Martian.
Yes.
Yes.
Based on the book, Matt Damon marooned on Mars. I've heard this described as, you know that scene in Apollo 13 where they sort of, they have to fix the ship with like the table full of tools, and they have to say, right, we've got this, that, and the other, how do we fix the ship? I've heard this described as, what if that was a whole movie? What if that scene?
Brilliant. Wow. Well, I'm my brother's read the book and he's raving about it, and I am going to go see it and probably hate it, and then we're going to talk about it in the studio.
Hooray.
For your listening pleasure. So that's in 2 weeks' time. Thank you very much, Matt, for another fantastic review. I think it's probably time for me to mention something really cool that's happened to the Black Show Arts Hour in the last couple of weeks, which is the fact that we're a podcast now.
Heck
we've
yeah.
kind of butterflied, or, I don't know, mothed into butterfly sort of thing.
Pupated?
Yeah, we've pupated.
Yeah.
We Good
did,
for us.
We did a thing, and now we're on iTunes. So
yes, we're easy to subscribe to,
yeah,
so get subscribing.
Definitely go and type us into the search bar in iTunes or into your podcast app. We are the Black Show Arts Hour, and you can subscribe and just have us on your phone or wherever you listen to podcasts every 2 weeks. It's so easy now. So easy, Vix.
You don't have to clear your schedule at 6 on a Sunday
anymore.
No,
you don't even have to listen
to
live. Yeah, listen to us live because it's more fun, and you know, I go back and edit this sometimes.
Yeah, and I'm tweeting about it, so hooray. That's the live element that you get.
Is that what you're doing down there?
Yeah, doing a little live tweet
okay.
of the show.
We're live tweeting as well.
Live tweeting.
At Black Show Update.
So that's the added benefit of tuning in at 6, but otherwise, you can get it as a podcast as well.
Yes. So what I said at the top of the show today was the fact that we are kicking off promotion of Staying Alive, which is Black Show's next big production. It is occurring on the 10th of November and running all the way till the 29th. And we are going to play you some interviews this evening. The first one is director Ellie Pitkin, who is occasionally in the studio with us presenting this show. This is an interview with her about her directing Staying Alive.
My name's Ellie Pitkin and I am the director for Staying Alive.
How are you feeling about getting back on with Staying Alive?
I was just talking to Ellie, one of our cast members, actually. We were just both saying how excited we are at this point. And I think for a lot of projects, the excitement is overridden by anxiety. But for this one, the balance has tipped very much in the favour of excitement. I'm really looking forward to it. It's such a fantastic play. The writing is so there that I don't need to search for meaning in everything, which is often what you have to do when you get a text. And the characters are already so fully formed on the page that it really gives us the luxury of playing with what's there.
I have to say, maybe I was a bit surprised. I mean, I'm not saying that I think you should be nervous, but I think if I was approaching a play with a difficult subject matter, like Staying mm-hmm. Alive, I might be apprehensive. But do you think that's because you've directed it before?
I think that's probably why. I mean, it's certainly not to say that I don't have some concerns about doing a show where there are so many sensitive issues involved. But I think the showcase performance we did in January of this year really gave us a lot of confidence as a team about handling the subject matter. And as I say, because the play is so beautifully written, a lot of the pressure is taken off me as director because I don't have to so much consider, oh, if I make this decision in terms of direction, is that going to read right for an audience, or is it going to horribly offend 50% of the people sat there? For me, it feels a lot like the writing is such a safe pair of hands that actually I don't have to be quite so worried about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see that because it sort of everybody's just laid bare by it almost.
Yeah.
And any awkwardness that there is, it's
yeah.
just...
And I think we get out a lot of the awkwardness in rehearsals because, for me, I hadn't worked with most of the cast when we did this performance in January, and it's much the same cast this time around. We had lots of discussions quite early on, particularly because we had such a short rehearsal process as well. I was very aware we kind of needed to all lay it out on the table for each other quite clearly at the beginning in terms of what our attitudes towards the subject matter were and what was okay to say in rehearsal and what wasn't. And I was really pleased that all of the cast had the same approach to me, which was anything goes and nothing is offensive. And a lot of that kind of confidence to do that came from the work we did with the bereavement charity Slow. A wonderful, wonderful lady runs that called Nick Whitworth. And she was very generous with her time and with what she talked to us about. And she was very honest and open and came and talked to us at a rehearsal. And she kind of, I felt like she gave us permission to have that anything goes policy. We talked a lot about what's helpful, what can you do as a friend of a bereaved person, what can you say, what can you do to help. And something that actually made it into the play is you can't make it worse. So I think for a lot of people, particularly British people, there's this very kind of prescribed way that we're taught to deal with it. You take them a lasagna and you say, I'm so sorry. And then you don't really talk about it. And I think one of the ways this play kind of explores those issues is to showcase all the ways that people get it right and get it wrong, and the way it can affect the person you're talking to. So hearing her anecdotes about, you know, what people say is fantastic.
Have you done anything else in terms of preparing yourself, warming up?
Well, as I say, the first time we did the show in January, I felt like I didn't do as much preparation as I wanted to, because it was such a short rehearsal process. It was part of our showcase award scheme at Blackshaw, and the kind of basis of that is you get a one night only industry performance of your piece. So this time round, I got a lovely list of books recommended to me by Nicola Whitworth, and I am making my way through those, and I'm finding that really helpful and interesting. It's just on a personal level as well as in preparation for the play. And we have got a much more generous time frame this time round in terms of, you know, having a table read, having workshop sessions, having a nice sort of stretched out rehearsal. So I think it feels quite luxurious.
Ooh.
Yeah, luxury preparation time.
That's great. What do you think's the greatest challenge for the play, for you?
I think actually, having said, you know, that we're having a luxurious preparation process, that I'm reading around the subject and I'm really looking forward to rehearsals, whilst all of that is absolutely true, I still think the biggest challenge is the obvious one, which is presenting the work and the subject in a way that is accessible and enjoyable to as many people as possible. And I think that with this subject matter, that is incredibly difficult. The death of a child is one of the last taboos, I think.
Yeah.
So that in itself is the greatest challenge. And I just am really, really grateful that I've got such a fantastic team of people, a fantastic cast, amazing writing to work with, and great support from the team at Blackshaw as well, to put the production together. So we're really confident it's a really special piece, but I'm also ever aware of that responsibility.
Yeah, I suppose it's a paradox. What makes it such a draw is also what might make you reluctant.
Absolutely, absolutely. And actually putting together things like the publicity strategy for a show like this is so much harder than any other show I've worked on, because you're just constantly wondering how the work's going to be perceived when you can't have everyone looking at the poster read the play.
Yeah.
I think once you've read or seen the play, you get it, and it's so universal, both in its theme and in its presentation, that I genuinely think everyone will get it if they see it, but it's getting them to come to see it.
Well, I think based on this, people will be able to tell that it's in incredibly safe hands. So thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
That was the wonderful Helen Johnson talking to director of Staying Live, Ellie Pitkin, who is occasionally in the studio and a co-presenter on the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. Staying Alive is happening on the 10th of November, and tickets are available now. I believe we have tweeted a link from our own...
At Wandsworth Radio has tweeted a link to the Pleasant.
And yes, there will be one from the Blackshaw Twitter feed as well, shortly.
Yes, if you are following along as Vicky is live tweeting the show. There's going to be two more of those interviews coming up on the show as well, but right now we are going to talk Arts Thing of the Week with Vicky Weston in the studio.
Yes, it's very exciting, isn't it?
Yeah.
This week, actually it was last week, I started to find that lots of articles and things about the same topic were cropping up in my sphere of attention, mostly on the internet. But it was when I read an article in Stylist magazine on the tube on the way home the other week that it kind of really came to a head. And it was about a film that's due to be released on the 12th of October called Suffragette, which I'm sure would make for excellent reviewing on the film review 1 week, if we can fit it in.
Noted.
And it's got an all-star cast of ladies, including Kerry Mulligan, Romola Garai, Helena Bonham Carter, Anne-Marie Duff, Meryl Streep. Do I need to go on? Probably not.
No.
Didn't know Romola Garai was in it.
Everyone's in it. Yeah. If you're not in it, then what's the point? Obviously, Meryl Streep's playing Emmeline Pankhurst, but the story's really focused on a working-class woman played by Kerry Mulligan and how she's kind of drawn into the fight. But anyway, the reason that I'm bringing it up is, of course, Stylist magazine were interviewing them about the film, but they also asked them about their perceptions around the kind of gender problems in the film industry, of which there are many and too many to talk about right now. But one of the things that really jumped out at me, and this is as a result of seeing these kind of other articles crop up, is that there's a particular issue that actually had kind of escaped my notice, and I feel a bit shamefaced about it. And I feel like it's summed up by this amazing quote from Emma Thompson, who is one of my favourite actresses of all time because she's totally awesome, where she says, "I remember someone once saying to me that I was too old for Hugh Grant, who's like a year younger than me in Sense and Sensibility. And I said, do you want to go and take a flying leap?" And firstly, I'd like to say props to Emma Thompson for being a legend, but that this calls to my attention an issue around the age gap between men and women in film.
Oh, yeah.
And what I'm really frustrated about is not just the fact that this problem exists, but that I hadn't really noticed it. And that I kind of find embarrassing. Well, I'd noticed it in some things, but there are quite a lot of films that I then found in this BuzzFeed article where I was like, oh yeah, oh my goodness, I've seen that film. And when I watched it, I didn't think, why is this woman playing opposite a guy who is like 30 years older than her? For example,
I feel like, hang on, just before you go on, have we spoken about this?
We have,
this,
and
Matt?
I'm just trying.
What movie was it in relation to?
I'm just trying to work that out.
Was it when we put a poll out on Twitter and we were trying to? No, that wasn't it. We asked everyone what age that they thought someone was.
It was Tom Cruise.
It was Tom Cruise,
and he was starring with his co-star in Mission Impossible 5. And
who was about 20 years younger.
Who was about 20 years younger. So she's a really good example of a recent one, right? But one of the ones that actually I want to call people's attention to is a film that's just come out called A Walk in the Woods, where Emma Thompson, who is 56 years old, is playing opposite Robert Redford, who is 79. So it's not just a problem that young actresses are facing. This is a problem that all female actresses seem to be facing in any film they're in. That it's totally, and I'm not saying there's a problem. There are plenty of people who are in genuine relationships who have a 20-year age gap. I'm not calling into question the kind of legitimacy of that. It's just that there obviously is this problem whereby they look at Robert Redford and say, "Who's a suitable romantic partner for him?" It has to be someone who's in their early 50s. And I kind of find that surprising.
I've seen graphs of this.
I'm going to mention graphs. Okay, so Vulture.com.
Coming to graphs, Matt.
Coming
quiet
to graphs.
Down.
So obviously we've got to see the research that backs this up, right? So Vulture.com. And this might be the same set of graphs, but I'd be interested to know if it isn't, have done a set of graphs that charts a particular leading man in their films that they've been in and their age that they were as they were in them. So obviously that's just an upward trajectory. And then the age of their female co-stars. And obviously it shows the age gap because there's a blue line for them and a pink line for the ladies. And it's fascinatingly revealing that the age of the man just continues to go up, obviously, because he's just getting older. And the age of the women either stays roughly the same or actually in some cases gets younger, which is kind of fascinating. But anyway, what this BuzzFeed article did, which I quite enjoyed, was that they gender swapped it. So they took examples and then said, so if, for example, in A Walk in the Woods, where Robert Redford is opposite Emma Thompson, if we were to flip that age gap, he would need to be paired with an actress who was 23 years older than him, and that would make her 101. Or, for example, in Get Smart, where Steve Carell, who's 46, was paired with Anne Hathaway, who was 26, if they were to flip that, he would be starring opposite Barbara Streisand. It's like, these examples are just fantastic, and it really kind of makes you laugh, and you kind of think, actually, that's really ridiculous. And it's like, well, hang on a minute, why is it only ridiculous in the way round where the woman is much older than the man?
Yeah. It's funny, it's that thing of saying, you know, women in theatre, film, whatever kind of, you know, medium that they're in, they have this age where they just cut off and there is no
Yeah, like
need.
A sell-by date.
Yeah, they have a sell-by date, but there is no need for these middle-aged women who clearly exist in the world.
Yes.
And I see them every day, but do you see them on a screen? No. They don't exist.
So Anne Hathaway, who I did just mention, said in an article, she's 33. so she's not old by any stretch of the imagination, that she is now considered too old to be playing a romantic lead unless the actor she's playing opposite is in his 50s, I presume.
Yeah, which is happening, actually, because I saw a trailer for something that Anne Hathaway is in with Robert De Niro.
Yes, The Intern.
Oh, yeah. My God, that looks atrocious.
Yes, it does, it does. So this is where we're at
but
here.
But that's proving that completely. Yeah. I mean...
It is frustrating, but the reason that I'm bringing it up is for a positive reason, actually, not just because I'm quite irritated by the whole thing. And now that I've noticed it, I'm seeing it everywhere, so I think that's a good thing as well. But there are some people doing something about it. So Gina Davies of Thelma and Louise fame she is a formidable and totally awesome 6-foot actress, so she's therefore too tall to play romantic leads, of course, and she's 59 years old, so she's therefore too old to play romantic leads as well, but she actually has her own research-led institute for gender and media called the Gina Davis Gender and Media Institute.
Wow.
I know, it's incredible.
That's fantastic.
So the reason I'm bringing this up is that the London Film Festival is about to kick off, and she is speaking at a symposium about gender and media on the 8th of October, which is the week after next.
That sounds great.
And I believe tickets are still available. So if anyone's like me gone, oh my goodness, how is this a thing? And how have I never noticed it was, like, how is it not really ever permeated my consciousness before? I really urge you to kind of go and check out the symposium if you're free to go and see it. Incidentally, they are actually also showing an early release of Suffragette at that film festival as well.
Oh, fantastic.
So I've done a beautiful circular
tour
around my anger about this issue. But yeah, so I just thought, you know, you've kind of given me some thoughts already, and I know we briefly talked about it in regards to Mission Impossible a few weeks ago, and it's just something that, yeah, it's been cropping up more and more, and I thought, actually, the fact that someone's doing something about it, that is worth an Arts Thing of the Week.
And where I've seen it cropping up is around the discussion around Spectre, the new Bond film, because one of his romantic interests in that is Monica Bellucci, who I think is actually, she's either older or very near the age of Daniel Craig.
Yes, I think she must be in her, I think she's like 51 or 2 perhaps. Yeah. Worth looking up. We will come back with that information. But yes, that's an interesting...
Born in 1964.
Yeah.
That's funny, I keep calling it Scepter for some reason.
Nope, that's what it's called.
Anyway, moving on swiftly. Thank you very much, Vicky, for your Arts Thing of the Week. We are going to go straight into another interview of a Staying Alive cast member. Helen Johnson is interviewing Ellie Burke.
I'm Eleanor Burke, and I'm playing Jen.
Tell us a little bit about Jen. What's the most important thing for us to know?
Well, Jen is... Jen is the friend that everyone has, and the person that wants to and really believes that she's doing the right thing. Everything that she's doing is motivated from a good place, but she can tend to get things maybe slightly wrong. In the play, she's the wife of Jack, who's Mary's best friend, and they're all really, really good friends, and they have lovely dinner parties, and she always cooks the most wonderful dish, and she's the hostess with the mostess, and, you know, she looks after people, you know, she cares people to death, you know. Her idea about people dealing with loss and bereavement is that really, really people need to get on with it, and even though she thinks what she's saying to Mary is... Or the way she's behaving is coming from the right place. She's really just trying to kind of dust everything under the carpet, sweep everything under the carpet, so that, because she wants everything to be happy and bright and cheerful, and, you know, but sometimes people need a bit of space, and she doesn't give Mary the space maybe that she needs.
How do you feel about playing a character there where maybe one of their flaws is so near the surface?
She's very different to me, so I've kind of had to, really, really, really think about it and take inspiration from other people who shall not be named, that I've encountered in life. I do have sympathy with the character, and I think that's what's important when playing a character that is so kind of obviously flawed.
Yeah.
Is that you have to have sympathy and understand where they're coming from, and I understand where she's coming from, and you know, she has integrity, but she's just too busy trying to make everything perfect that she can't allow there to be cracks and allow people to heal, which is actually what is needed sometimes.
Yeah, would you say that sort of difficult, that tension with the character, really, where she's trying to do the best, but you know it's got to come across as not ideal. Is that the biggest challenge of the character for you, do you think?
I think any character, when you get going with it, is a challenge, because you've got to inhabit it. It's got to become you, and you have to live it. And I think I've got to the point now where I just slip into it so comfortably. Mm. She's got a kind of really high metabolism. She's very kind of quick and fastidious. You know, she moves around quickly. She's constantly tidying and busying.
Yeah.
So I can feel a bit tired after rehearsals, because she's kind of the one rallying people around and going, oh, would you like another glass of wine? Yes. Or can I get you anything? Would you like a vol-au-vent? Would you like hors d'oeuvres? You know, what can I get for you? Look at it, wonderful. Darling, it's so good to see. She's that person.
Yeah.
So it's a bit tiring.
So as you've suggested there, you've played the part before. Can you sort of explain your relationship with Staying Alive?
I have been lucky to work, to be part of it from quite an early stage, and certainly I was involved in the production.
Yeah, the showcase in January.
Showcase, yes. And so that was very much a kind of full performance of the show, and it was a really wonderful experience. And I'm lucky enough to be coming back and doing it again.
Were you daunted then to be asked to come back into it, or were you excited?
Not at all, absolutely, really excited. I've got so much respect, I don't respect the word, I'm really passionate about the work.
Yeah.
I think Kat's writing is brilliant. I think it's a gift for actors. It's just so well written, it's just so easy to work with, it's just wonderful. And the other actors are fantastic, and and I just think the piece itself is just so interesting. And also Slow the Charity and Nick and everybody that's involved on that side of things is just great, and I know that the piece means so much to so many people. And I think it's a subject that's shied away from. People don't want to talk about loss.
No.
And how do we talk about loss, and how do we confront that? And bereavement is so individual to every single person. I just think it's such a bold and brave, I don't know, investigation or look into that subject, because, you know, as soon as somebody dies and you know, you what do you say? You know, what do you do? How do you deal with that? And of course, there is no right or wrong way, really, I think. But.
So is this far away from the roles that you've played before? What's your comfort zone?
I don't know if I have a comfort zone. I've had a strange run of things. I did... I was actually drawing similarities between, strange as it might seem, Beverly from Abigail's Party, who I played recently, and I just adore Alison Steadman and that part. So that was one of the last things I did. I don't really have a comfort zone as such. I kind of do quite a lot of varied stuff.
I can see that with Abigail's Party, almost this stiffness and that swell.
Would you like an olive? All right. Yeah. Well, it's that kind of, I'm going to look after you even if you don't like it, yeah. Sort of thing. But although I think, they are obviously very different.
Of course, but no, I can see that, yeah. Absolutely. So there was this option you had when you were speaking to the guys from Slow, where mm-hmm. you were just chucking questions at them mm-hmm. to sort of get a better idea of... how things might feel, or what advice they might have. How was that?
It was really interesting, because I felt that Nick was so honest. And what was interesting from her point of view, in a way, was that she was like, in actual fact, we do things wrong too. Sometimes, you know, a person that's going through loss, we can behave badly. We can push people away, you know, and... So I think that that's important as well in this play, is that even though naturally we sympathise with the main protagonist, with Mary, we sympathise with her, in actual fact, it's not just about that. It's about everybody being affected, because it's not just the person that's immediate to the event. It's everybody gets caught up, and everybody's feelings matter, and there is so much more than just that one person that's lost somebody.
Yeah, I'd agree. It sort of feels like it's sort of really broken open, and then you're sort of dragged around in this mess. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's probably why it's such a satisfying play to watch. Yeah. Really looking forward to seeing it again. Thank you very much.
No, you're welcome.
That was our lovely Helen Johnson talking to Eleanor Burke about her role in Staying Alive that is coming up and starting at the Pleasance Theatre in Islington. It's Islington, isn't it, Vix?
Correct.
Yeah, I am right. On the 10th of November. The next thing that's coming up for Blackshaw, actually, is our new writing night on Wednesday. I'm going. Matt, are you going?
I think so.
Yay!
Hooray, we're all going!
Yeah, we love a good new writing night. I think we're doing four pieces this Wednesday at the Horse and Stables in Lambeth North. Owen Collins is coming down, who you've heard on this show. He does poetry for us. He is going to be performing some live poetry. So come down for that on Wednesday. Tickets are £4 advance and £5 on the door. And then also coming up in November on the 25th, which we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, is Blackshaw's first ever Scare Slam, which we are going to be recording for playing on Wandsworth Radio on the Blackshaw Arts Hour. So it is essentially a night where you can come and have a story prepared and sit in the audience and hear some stories. And also, if you want to tell your scary story, you can get up and actually tell it.
Campfire style. Yeah. Just you and a mic and no props or
no
acting.
Props. It's very stripped down. It's basically we're giving you a chair and that's it and an audience. The audience is quite an important thing because otherwise you'd just be a crazy person in a pub.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
There has to be someone to scare. Otherwise, how will we know who's won?
Exactly. So the Blackshaw Scare Slam is coming up on Wednesday, the 25th of November. If you'd like to be involved, if you'd like to do a story or a scare the pants off of the audience that we are going to provide for you, you can tweet at Helen, AIMEEJ. It's quite a difficult...
I'm going to tweet it. Don't worry.
We're going to tweet it out from our actual Twitter account so that you know who to tweet.
Which is Blackshaw Update.
Blackshaw Update on Twitter. Also, if you're not using Twitter and it confuses you like it confuses me, then you can email Helen at helen@blackshawonline.com and ask her to be involved. And you can be involved, like Matt is going to be involved.
I am.
Yeah. That's the next exciting thing that we have coming up. Now we are going to talk to Matt a little bit about something that I've seen a lot of posters around London for, and it's kind of freaked me out, and I want to know if it freaked Matt out, and it's Pomona, not Paloma.
Not Paloma.
Pomona. No,
Pomona. So this is a play. It's currently at the National in the Temporary Theatre.
Is it the red one?
That is the red one.
Red box.
Yeah. Yep. Formerly the Shed. It debuted at the Orange Tree. It's played by Alistair McDowell, directed by Ned Bennett. Okay, let me attempt to sum it up. So, it's set in Manchester. People are going missing. And Ollie, played by Nadia Clifford, thinks her twin sister might be one of them. So she's come to Manchester to try and find her. There is a man who seems to own nearly everything in Manchester and yet lives like a tramp. There's a pair of characters who are security for something, but they're not sure what they're guarding or why or for whom. And at the centre of everything, there is this weird patch of waste ground in Manchester called Pomona, which is just this patch of concrete with tram lines and canal on all sides that nobody really uses or knows what it's for. And it is a completely weird, disturbing, unsettling piece of theatre.
Okay, great.
Do you have specific questions about like the publicity stuff that you've seen?
Okay, so the publicity stuff that I've seen is, and I'm not sure if everyone else has seen it around London, it's a picture of a man wearing a giant squid face thing. And I also watched the trailer on the National website today, and it just confused me.
Yeah. So I think what you see in the trailer is the man who owns everything eating chicken nuggets.
Yeah, that's right. And then there's like a war of... is it a Warhammer or what's that weird game?
It's
with
Dungeons
the
and Dragons.
That's the one.
So there are some Dungeons and Dragons sequences. Part of it is... Everybody's very alone and is very sort of is reaching out to try and create connections. So one of the security guards is trying to start up a Dungeons and Dragons game as a way of making friends.
Sure.
And the other one is just sort of seeking human contact, and Ollie is looking for her family. So everybody's very sort of atomized, which I think is part of the reason that... So we talked, when we mentioned this the other week, I talked about Dan Rebellato's review of it, which called it the play of the decade and said it might change the way we write plays. I'm not sure where he got that comment about it changing how we write plays. It does have a very... It's got a very disjointed time structure. It's this sort of weird, sort of spirally fragmented structure. So it's always jumping backwards and forwards in time. There's a little bit of a memento feel to how it's put together. But in terms of it being the play of the decade, I can kind of see what he means. Because I think when people are looking back to now and sort of writing their histories of theatre in the 2010s, mm-hmm. I think this Pomona will be kind of indicative of the mood that plays are trying to capture. So it's this urban living and everybody being very alone. Lots of characters talk about their hopes and dreams, but the most that they hope for is one hopes that he will wake up one morning and everybody in the world will have disappeared. And one character hopes that she'll come back to the city on fire and burn everything to ashes. So everybody's got these very bleak aspirations. Yeah. And so the squid mask that you mention is a direct reference to H.P. Lovecraft, who wrote lots of existential cosmic horror.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a lot of J.G. Ballard in it as well, kind of in the subtext, which is all about the sort of the urban decay and people living in cities and being very miserable with their lives.
Yeah.
So it's unexpectedly funny for all that. I feel like I need to mention that, having made it sound horribly bleak. It's unexpectedly sort of blackly comic.
Mm-hmm.
And has a really sort of gut-punching twist at the end with that sort of memento-type reveal.
Yeah, I read some reviews on it, and I'm really intrigued, not just because I'm intrigued by a squid mask, because that really gets me into things. But no, it sounds fantastic. I think it's running up until the 10th of October at the National. Am I right in saying? Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think I got that right. But yeah, go off and see,
yes,
Pomona.
You definitely did. I've just looked it up.
Fantastic. I got something right. Yay. thank you very much, Matt, for coming in and talking to us about Pomona, which sounds interesting and bleak, but... also,
I think it's touring up to the north when it leaves the National.
I think I read that as well. Yeah. So yeah, get along and see that one. I am going to play you right now another Staying Alive cast interview. This one is with Alexander Pankhurst, who is playing the part of Jack.
My name's Alexander Pankhurst, and I'm playing Jack in Staying Alive.
What do we know about Jack at the start of the play?
He is a friend of Mary's, who is the protagonist. They've been friends since university, but that kind of comes out as the play progresses. You don't know that from the get-go. And it's not as comfortable as old friends usually are.
That sounds like a really unusual dynamic. They've known each other a long time, but it's not comfortable, and it's men and women, it's not romantic. Is it unusual for you to play a character like that?
I think the play in general is something that I've never done anything like before. Usually the character arc is a lot more obvious, but with this, because there is history and it briefly flicks back to that history, so you get to see how they were and how they did function and how well they functioned together, and then you see them later down the line in the present just not functioning at all. And that is going to be a challenge for me as an actor, to try and really convey that sense that, yes, they do know each other. They know each other very well, but it's in a weird period where Jack just simply doesn't know how to deal with Mary, because she's grieving so heavily.
So let's circle back round to the beginning, I suppose. You saw Staying Alive in January, didn't you, at the showcase?
Yes, yeah, I did. I saw it at the showcase and was blown away by the writing, the acting. Everything was really, really spot on. Just a really, really good performance. And for me as an individual, I always know when I'm watching something that I'm really enjoying, because I want to be up on stage with them. So to now actually have that opportunity to do so is, one, daunting, because I know it was really good, so I don't want to be the guy that messes it up. But at the same time, you get a chance to be like, I can play with this, I can do this, and that's really exciting for me.
If my memory serves me correctly, this is the second production you've done with Blackshaw that originated at a Blackshaw New Writing Night? Because Ghostfinder went through the same route.
That is correct. Yeah, that is absolutely correct.
Do you think
yeah.
you're particularly drawn to new writing?
I wouldn't have said so in the past, no. I don't think it would have been something that I would have said was on my radar as something that I'm drawn towards. So getting an opportunity to work in so much new writing has made me much more excited about it. And it's nice being able to go up to people and say, I'm going to be in a piece of new writing. And you can see the look on some people's faces like, oh, new writing, I don't know if I should go and see that because it's new and it might be really edgy. It's like, it's a really cracking story. I've seen it before. It's tried, it's tested. You're going to love it. Come on down and see it. So that's really nice to be able to enthuse about a project like that.
So do you think that's because you can be generally more experimental, or is it maybe something to do with feeling like you've originated a character?
For me, acting is all about playing, especially with Blackshaw, the way in which they operate. There's no set guidelines, so you don't go in and go, right, we want you to do this, this and this. They're like, right, this is a character, run with it, we'll help you, guide you, shape it with you, and hopefully something good comes out of it at the end. I think the experimentation and being able to have free reign over something that's completely untouched, obviously now it has been touched, which, you know, makes it just rubbish for me now, obviously.
It's just a little smudge.
Yeah,
it's not
just
like
a smudge, you know.
Full
yeah.
kneading.
Yeah, but no. Looking forward to it. Really looking forward to it.
Great. Well, so are we. We're glad to have you in yet another Blackshaw show. Thanks very much.
Not a problem at all.
That was Helen Johnson talking to Alexander Pankhurst about his performance in Staying Alive, which is coming up on the 10th of November. We have absolutely inundated you with Staying Alive content this evening because we are so excited about it being on stage again. And coming up now, this is the first ever playing we're going to do. You're going to be hearing it a lot over the next coming weeks. But our wonderful Andy Crane has produced this fantastic audio trailer for our upcoming production of Staying Alive.
Miss Evans, have a seat, please.
Mary, it's Mary.
Jen.
What?
I don't know what to say. What am I supposed to do?
I understand that you have had a horrific experience today.
We're her friends, Jack.
I can't say how sorry I am about your son, Henry.
We're supposed to do friendship.
In the event that a child dies unexpectedly in the home, the local authority has a responsibility to find out about what happened.
My nan died once.
Just the once?
Yeah. And I was so sad for like weeks.
I know you must feel like you've been singled out, especially when you've already been through so much.
I was hoping that in addition to losing my only child, I wouldn't also have to experience the most awkward night of my life with one of my oldest friends.
My role today is to find out from you what happened to Henry.
God, I know, I'm a mess. I don't know what to say. I saw you and I knew I was going to make it worse.
I promise you, you can't make it worse.
I will need to ask you some difficult questions.
Do you want to talk about it?
I've had cheery conversations.
Mary?
Thought seeing friends would be a comfort.
Do you understand?
There's nothing worse than old friends.
Mary?
They always think they know exactly who you are.
Do you understand?
Yes.
Do you feel that you're ready to proceed?
Blackshaw Theatre presents Staying Alive, a new play by Kat Roberts, showing this November at the Pleasance Theatre. Tickets on sale now at pleasance.co.uk.
Music in that audio trailer by Kevin MacLeod, and thanks to Andy Crane for putting that together for us. That has been the show this evening. It's gone really fast, guys.
Yeah,
it really has.
Yeah. Thank you very much to Matt and Vicky for being in the studio with me next week. Not next week, I seriously can't get my head around saying that. In a fortnight's time on the Blackshaw Arts Hour, Helen Johnson will be in the studio talking to us about Photograph 51. Matt is going to be doing The Martian. I'm going to hate it. And we will see you then. Bye.
Bye.